tuned in to Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM in the East Bay, and on the web at berkeleyliberationradio.net. This is Radio Autonomía, Autonomy Radio, Zapatismo in the Bay. Our collective media project takes inspiration from the Zapatista movement in Chiapas, Mexico, and focuses on autonomous political, economic, and social projects in the Bay Area that resonate with the anti-capitalist rebel spirit of Zapatismo. I'm DJ Alita, and we're here every first Sunday of every month from 4 to 6 p.m. To listen to and download past Radio Autonomía segments and shows, you can visit our website at radioautonomia.wordpress.com. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or you want to get involved with the show, shoot us a message at radioautonomia@gmail.com. Today's show will feature an in-depth conversation about the Escuelita Zapatista with a few of our close comrades here in the Bay Area who recently returned from Chiapas. Following the celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Caracoles Zapatistas, from August 12th to 16th, 1,700 people arrived in Zapatista territory to participate in the first round of the Escuelita Zapatista, the little school on freedom according to the Zapatistas. Journalist Raúl Zibeki, who participated in the Escuelita, wrote the following about his experience. There will be a before and after of the little Zapatista school, of the recent one and those that will come. It will be a slow, diffuse impact, which will be felt in some years, but will frame the life of those below for decades. What we experienced was a non-institutional education, where the community is the educational subject. Face-to-face self-education, learning with the spirit and with the body, as the poet would say. Our compañero Gustavo Esteva from the Universidad de la Tierra Oaxaca wrote the following. We drank from the fountain of inspiration until we were sated. We also learned that everyone can do what they need to do in their own way, with as much diversity as we find in all of our worlds. We can create a world where we all fit. Inertia, paralysis, and fears will be shaken. We are on our way. In the conversation that follows, which we recorded a few days ago here in Oakland, our compañeros and compañeras from the Universidad de la Tierra Califas shared some of their experiences at the Escuelita and reflect on the significance of this experience for their struggles here in the Bay Area. We'll hear the whole conversation after a quick musical break.
Are you ready to begin?
Here in Oakland with some members and dear compañeros of Radio Autonomía to talk about the Escuelita Zapatista, which recently had its first session in Chiapas, in the Caracoles. So we wanted to just kind of talk to y'all for Radio Autonomía to get a sense of what your experience was like, what the Escuelita was all about for you. And sort of impressions that you had, and get into some of the kind of details of sort of what really went down.
And maybe to start off, we could have you tell us a little bit about what the Escuelita Zapatista really is, and how you got involved. For a lot of us from afar, it was this kind of cryptic, mysterious thing, sort of in the time leading up to it, you know, with these communiques and sort of references to needing to be invited and how to access information about it. So I'm wondering sort of what it looked like on the ground for you all. Whoever wants to start and jump in. And if you want to introduce yourself along the way.
Well, my name is Elisa, and I'm part of Universidad de la Tierra Califas. And I guess generally, like you said, that the Escuelita was proposed in December after the December 21st action that the Zapatistas had in Chiapas, which brought out over 40,000 Zapatistas to the streets of San Cristobal and other main cities in Chiapas. And the main message there was, did you hear, escucharon, did you hear us, did you listen? And so they, right after that action, they proposed this Escuelita to the world and inviting us to come to their communities and kind of listen to them and hear them out and learn from them. And so that was the first kind of initial proposal. And I don't know if you guys would.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm Manolo, and I'm with Universidad de la Tierra and Acción Zapatista. And I agree that December 21st certainly got everybody's attention, much like January 1st in 94. And the mobilization was profound, and level of organization was also kind of very compelling and noteworthy. So I think, as in January 1, 94, and December 21st, and this year, or last year, people realized that something was going to happen, that something was afoot. So people were expectant, I think. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the Escuelita had two kinds of folks that attended. Folks who'd been there for a long time, I've been there since 94, been attending various encuentros and gatherings that the Zapatistas have hosted, and other folks who are new to the Zapatista solidarity kind of community and to some of those spaces. So there were both kinds of people, which made it that space, made the Escuelita very interesting in that sense. But I think, most people were expectant that something was going to happen. And then, of course, the communiques started to convey what the Escuelito would be over time. And people had to kind of be patient with it. And I think, there was some confusion for many people about how to get invited or who was going to be invited and what that meant. And it was difficult for some people to actually find their way to the Escuelita, I think, in some ways. So we need to talk, I think at some point we need to talk about that in terms of like how the Zapatistas convened and hosted and then facilitated the space. On the other hand, I didn't find it so terribly problematic. It wasn't hard for us to actually be invited. Mm-hmm. So we were able to participate. And it's worth mentioning that we participated as part of a larger group. In fact, we were part of Universidad de la Tierra kind of contingency. There were some 50 people from Universidad de la Tierra in Oaxaca. And of course, Universidad de la Tierra in Chiapas was central to the facilitation for the organizing, the hosting, the convening of it. CEDESI and UNITIERRA Chiapas. And we were there as Universidad de la Tierra Califas. And so we were... That was one of the ways that we were able to participate, in that people clearly recognized that we were doing some kind of Zapatismo outside of Chiapas, and that we'd been doing that for some time. And I think there was some strategy behind the invitations and the way the invitations went out slowly, and the way the information about the invitation went out very slowly, just to really kind of filter and say, well, who are people who are actually doing Zapatismo? But not... It didn't mean that they just had to be a traditional solidarity community group, right? Just only in solidarity with the Zapatistas. But thinking through some kind of zapatismo. And that will be central for the Escuelita, you know, how do we connect with different kinds of projects that are around autonomy and liberty that, like, resonate with zapatismo, even though they may not deliberately kind of carry the banner or have the insignias of zapatistas or something mm-hmm. like that, right?
So when you mentioned that there were sort of newcomers to the Zapatista scene, like what kind of groups and what kind of projects were those folks coming from?
So my name is Ricardo Mazo with Unitierra Califas and Acción Zapatista. And I guess I would call myself a newcomer. I've never been to Chiapas. That was my first experience going down to the Caracoles and the communities, you know, fortunately, into the communities. So I guess as far as newcomers, it was everybody. And I kind of want to go back to the other question mm-hmm. as far as like what the escuelitas looked on the ground. Just for folks, I don't know, who have a more visual kind of sense of they want to see it visually or hear it and visualize it. And, you know, we were there a few days before, but there was 2 days of registration where we showed up, registered, make sure we had all our materials. And that's actually when folks let us know where we were going to be heading to, what Caracol. Mm-hmm. The following day, you know, it was, as some folks called it, desmadre, a chaos mm-hmm. of everybody trying to figure out when their truck or bus was leaving to the different Caracoles, different 5 Caracoles. And
this was at
Sedesi. Yeah, Unitierra, Chiapas, Sedesi.
Which is kind of on the outskirts of San Cristobal.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, we're all waiting in line. We ended up, a few of us ended up in Oventic. So that's the closest Caracol to San Cristobal. So it only made sense that we would basically go last. Other folks ended up leaving and, you know, they had a 15-hour, 12-hour truck ride to wherever they were going. For us, we were fortunate. We had a 3-hour bus ride. So, you know, it wasn't too bad. But once we actually got to the Caracol, I mean, it was just an amazing, beautiful sight. We showed up. And you know, we were like the 4th bus, so it took us a while. We had to wait because they were basically greeting every single bus, and every bus held about 50 people. As soon as we got off, it was just, folks were just clapping. Folks were lined up on either side of us. You know, I don't know what the count was, but I want to say like 2,000 people or so.
There was, it was like in the middle of the night, and it was dark. We couldn't see anything but just hear a bunch of people clapping for us, a bunch of Zapatistas clapping wow. for the classmates coming in.
Yeah, and it was just a welcome, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was just amazing, and it felt very welcoming. And we all went to the auditorium, covered auditorium. And as soon as all of us arrived, you know, they asked if anybody had to use the restroom, all this stuff. You know, just really trying to take care of us and making mm-hmm. sure we're all okay. Especially because Oventic hosted a lot of the families.
Mm.
So a lot of the families with younger folks were there. So just want to make sure everybody was taken care of. As soon as everybody was there, you know, they started talking about what the rest of the night was going to look like, how we were going to be distributed out to different communities. There was going to be a line for families and a line for individuals. And they were going by buses, and it was a, you know, process of patience, and, you know, we're just kind of talking with folks around us, people who were on the bus, you know, just chatting it up. I think our turn, I don't know what time we arrived. It wasn't too late. It was like 9, 10 PM. It was 10 PM. And, you know, we didn't end up getting up to the line till about 3, 4 AM, you know,
wow.
And, you know,
to register,
to find out where we were going and who our botan or our guardian was. And actually, the botanes were up on, you know, there was a stage area, and they were all there also awake the whole time waiting for who they would be, you know, being taken, who they would take care of mm-hmm. as their mm-hmm. student. So, you know, that was pretty cool too, I guess, and you know, just showing just how organized things were,
mm-hmm.
you know, is the point of all this, just how organized things were and like how much folks were just ready to really receive us, even though it was 4 AM.
Yeah.
And we had to wake up at 7 AM to leave the next day. Yeah.
yeah. There was like 1,700 people, students, who were invited to go for this round. And there's going to be... So this was the first generation. They're calling it generation of students who attend the escuelitas. There's going to be a second one and a third one in December and January. And so it's crazy to think how much organization... This is all we kept talking about the whole time. It's just like how much... resources, energy, time, organization that it took for them to receive 1,700 people in this manner.
Yeah, and quite different, it sounds like, from the encuentros of past years, which were much less formal, it sounds like. You know, like Manolo, I had a chance to attend a lot of the encuentros in 2006 to 2010, more or less, and, you know, those were kind of these open events where anybody could show up, and you know, there was food and lodging and things provided, but it doesn't sound like it had anything near the level of organization and kind of conscious hospitality and sort of really taking seriously the role of hosting, right, and the role of being the guardians of the students, you know. So it's pretty impressive to hear about how that sort of played out for you all. So were you all in Oventic?
I was at CEDESI.
Okay.
At Unitierra, Chiapas, CEDESI.
So that was one of the sites also? It was the Caracoles and CEDESI.
It was the Caracoles and CEDESI.
And CEDESI, okay.
There was one group of us. The joke was there was the viejitos and the intellectuals and people who more or less didn't really want to be in the communities.
Okay.
Because of the hardship. They were worried that it would be difficult. So there was, you know, some very notable intellectuals. Pablo González Casanova, Gustavo Esteva, Adolfo Gili were together up front and honored in the communiques, but also in the moment of the initiation of the Escuelita. And their votan was Comandante David and Tacho, the two comandantes who more or less had the cargo of managing the Escuelita overall. So that was something. and we had this, we were in a very kind of formal, for me it was really exciting to be at CEDESI, because CEDESI Unitierra Chiapas is a campus that's completely built by the indigenous communities that kind of convene and make that learning space, a learning space. And so it's totally built from the ground up by them. And it's a beautiful campus. It's quite stunning. And so we were in a huge auditorium that they had built completely. And I don't know, it's just 300 or 400 of us or something, maybe a little more than 300. So, you know, we convened in a very formal way that was typical of the Zapatistas, and then we were assigned a votan. And yeah, it's a little exciting, you know, your name's called out and a cat comes out, you know, Julio comes out and he's coming out for you, you know, and he's, because we were told, to leave the seat open to our left. The seat to our left open. And then the votan, once we raised our hand, came and sat next to us. And he was going to, or she was going to be next to us, by our side, to answer questions and to dialogue with us and to learn with us together from the beginning to the end of the Escuelita.
And so this one-to-one pairing, that was consistent throughout...
Everybody had 1,700 guardians.
Wow. Every participant, with the exception of Gustavo, Adolfo,
and Pablo,
who had the two.
So they actually got shortchanged.
Right.
But, you know, Tacho and David count for a little extra.
Right.
Yeah.
and I think, really, I don't know about everybody else's, what they kind of gleaned, but I got a sense that there were two reactions to the votan. One reaction was very frustrated, dismissive. People were kind of not pleased because the votanes were distributed randomly. So you could be an older cat like myself. I'm 50 and my votan was 22. And some people were kind of put off by that. They wanted somebody, you know, older than them or at least their age. And you could hear complaints that people, well, you know, I have a 17-year-old who, you know, what can that 17-year-old teach me about anything, right? There was that. There was that.
Wow.
It was surprising, but there was that. And then the other reaction, and this is where, you know, I was part of this camp, we were just thrilled to have, you know, this totally devoted time with this young person or old person or whoever, but, you know, clearly somebody who has grown up in or lived in this autonomy and in this rebel base from its inception, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, many of us were just thrilled. Many of us felt we learned a lot. I had questions from 94 that I was able to ask.
Wow.
That I wasn't, you know, really able to ask. Mm-hmm. And I've been to a lot of encuentros, but there's just not a kind of context to ask, you know, certain kinds of questions that I was able to really explore with this young cat. You know, he's a beautiful young guy, you know, and it took the, and I think this is true of all the votanes, they took the cargo very seriously, you know, in numbers of levels. You know, one was just making sure that we were cared for, that, you know, we're totally not wanting for anything. And then also taking very seriously how to address our questions. And that was really the politics is, the escuelita, at least my experience in the Sedesi moment, was about questions. So we would read with our botan, or we would and talk and ask questions about what we're reading and kind of sort things out based on some of the presentation that initiated the morning. Because there would be five compañeros would kind of present some key ideas at the very beginning in the morning. Then we'd spend time with the botan and the cuadernos, and then and we return after comida to share questions that they would ask kind of publicly and address. And some of the questions weren't very serious, unfortunately. In fact, many of the questions weren't very serious. And that says a lot about the politics of the escuelita, and I think the strategy of the Zapatistas in convening the escuelita the way they did. We need to talk about that, but you know, it was really organized around questions. But the primary source of the interlocutor of the question was the votan, and that was brilliant.
Yeah,
that was brilliant. I have my critique about some of the pop ed strategy that could have been done just a little bit differently in terms of facilitating the space. Just some small critiques. But the votan was totally brilliant.
That sounds like it really was able to address, I think, one of the real shortcomings of so much of the interaction between members of Zapatista communities and folks from outside, you know, in quotes. But that's been an ongoing issue in encuentros, in the caracoles, in the, you know, human rights observation, in all of the ways that folks have come and participated in Chiapas, in the communities, there's been this ongoing issue of sort of a wall, right? A distance that is maintained intentionally or unintentionally, but a kind of inability to kind of move past that, to have that kind of one-on-one dialogue. I think that's been something that's been really paralyzing for a long time, and it sounds like this was addressing exactly that.
Absolutely. If I could just share one story. In 94, I was a human rights observer. In 95, I was a human rights observer. And three of us, you know, we drove 12 hours to get to a community that was kind of dealing with the low intensity, the very early stage of that low intensity war. And for me, that was a really critical moment politically for me, but also in terms of what was happening with the Zapatistas. So, you know, we walk into this community, we drive up and we walk into the community, and right away, you know, we get kind of settled for a second. They bring us down into, you know, down into this trail that you can't even see from this dirt road anymore, into a soccer pitch. And the entire community is assembled in this soccer pitch, right? The entire community is there. And they kind of introduce us, they welcome us. and then they kind of talk about what's at stake, and then they ask us to share our word, and, you know, what is it that we think, you know, we'll be able to contribute. Anyway, that for me was a profound moment as an anarchist to see an assembly like that organized, you know, self-organized to deal with this particular violence in the case of the 95, the low-intensity war in its early stage. But there were barriers there. There was no time or space to really talk about, like, the politics of assembly and the source of that assembly. Whereas at the Escuelita, during the course of our studies, that was the main focus, at least for me. And my botan and some cats that I know, I know some cats that were there, and they were talking with their botan, and we had some similar questions about, you know, how does the assembly work, and how is it a radical democratic or, you know, horizontal or direct democratic space? You know, how does it function on a daily basis and manage daily questions? And the cuadernos actually deal with that in large part as well, right? And so that was, for me, like the culmination of questions that I had had. And there was those barriers in 94 and 95, you know, in the CND. In the CND, I think we were very well hosted. And it was a very profound gathering. It was 7,000 people hosted in, you know, the first Aguascalientes in Guadalupe Tepeyac. That was, to me, very profound. I mean, how many places do you know that can convene 7,000 people where those 7,000 people are wanting for nothing for, you know, 3-4 days? But yeah, there were barriers. There was, you know, we could barely talk to each other in terms of, like, the U.S. contingent. There were, I don't know, it was 30 of us from the U.S. And we could barely talk to each other, much less talk to the Zapatistas. And at that time, the Zapatistas were still an army. Very much. What we encountered of the Zapatistas was an army, and in Escuelita, what we were encountering was the base community, and that was a major shift that I think we need to talk about at some point. Because the Escuelita was the base community; it wasn't the army. In CND in '94, we were surrounded and protected by the army. And anyway, some people were saying that this Escuelita was as profound as January 1, '94. Some people were saying that. Some of our dear friends were saying that. And yeah, we need to talk about that. Because,
So I'd love to hear a little bit more about kind of the day-to-day at the Escuelita. Sort of how are things organized? What kind of activities? What role did the materials, these textbooks that you've shared with us here, textbooks in quotes, but these packets of information, compiled specifically for the Escuelita, what role did those materials play? Sort of what were your experiences? So both of you were in Oventic?
Yeah, so okay. We were both in different communities in the Caracol of Oventic. And I can speak a little bit about the textbooks and the Guardian, and then maybe you can talk about your experience day to day. But kind of just to step back a little, there was a lot of work happening before the Escuelitas happened, and one of them was that they chose the Guardian months before, like 7-6 months before or something, the Escuelitas from each community. So each community had an assembly where they kind of chose different people to be the Guardianes for that community. And they read the material months before as well. And by the material, I mean the textbooks, which is like, there were 4 textbooks that they gave us. 2 on autonomous government. So it's Gobierno Autónomo 1 y Gobierno Autónomo 2. And then one was La Participación de las Mujeres en el Gobierno Autónomo, the participation of women in autonomous government. And the last one was Autonomous Resistance, right? That's the title. And so these 4 textbooks that they gave us, we had to read throughout the time we were there, and our guardians had read them before. And so we were able to ask them questions about the textbook, and then also ask them questions about the community that we were living and working in.
So, yeah, and just to add on to that, because I asked my guardian, my guardian, where everybody was that was chosen, because he gave me a certain number, and I said, well, but there's only 10 of us here, so what happened to the other guardianes? And he said, oh, the other ones got sent to Sedesi. So there were folks from all of the communities that also got sent out to Sedesi, you know, to be guardianes for folks. Which, you know, I thought that was interesting too, as far as like organizing that and who got to go. The day to day for me, I like narrating the whole experience because, you know, it was new to me, and I thought it was great, you know, the way just things, how things were so organized. When we arrived, there was an assembly again already ready to welcome everybody. Some of the folks who were in governance positions basically welcomed us. They had certain things written. Our botanes said something about us, some of the things that they've learned about us up to that point in introducing us. And then they just asked us to speak and say where we're from and what, you know, what we're looking forward to. So, you know, we also gave our word at that point. And then we went off to our different homes. I learned later that one of the rules was, I'm assuming in all the communities, is the participants or the students weren't allowed to actually interact with each other while we were there. So they intentionally made sure that we didn't see each other. Oh. That was something, at least my botan said, that, you know, they try to really uphold and try to make sure they honored, as far as our experience goes, that they don't want us to meet up until we had to reconvene again before leaving. So, you know, we arrived late. We had dinner with the family. You know, we talked. In my case, just introduced ourselves and introduced myself. And, you know, we just had a lot of questions for each other. You know, they wanted to know what it's like in California. You know, what we do out here. What are we struggling with? Immediately, folks wanted to know a lot of things. But then the day-to-day was just really going out with the families to different collectives. There was different collective projects. The ones at least that I interacted with were a collective milpa, you know, folks growing corn, beans, and squash collectively. There was a fish collective. They were growing freshwater fish. There was a chicken cooperative, eggs and chicken. And then there was bananas and then other herbs, that I don't remember the names of, but it was all collective shared work. Mm-hmm. And folks, you know, took that pretty seriously as far as whose turn it was and how it got managed, and ensuring that that got taken care of so that folks had, you know, access to those foods. In my case, I got sick. I showed up sick with a cold. So, you know, it was a little different. I got treated a little bit differently. They, you know, which showed, again, another level, right, is they want to make sure that folks are taken care of so that the labor and all the work happens, you know. There's no point to work a compañero or compañera, you know, to death.
Right.
Because then the work doesn't get done.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were working that day, and my botán noticed that I just kept, you know, blowing my nose and was breathing hard. And he said, you know what, let's just go to the Casa de Salud, which is basically like a small little clinic. And we went, you know, I kept telling him the whole way, I'm fine, don't worry. And he insisted, no, let's just make sure that it's not something serious. Because if that's the case, we have to make sure that gets managed. So we went, and, you know, the promotores or folks who help facilitate health in the community came out and asked me a few questions. And they actually gave me some pills, and, you know, in the course of 2 days, I definitely felt a lot better, decongested and all that, to the point where the last few days I was able to go on hikes and other places that you know, we needed to go and see. But the day-to-day, there was definitely, and this after talking with other folks, there was always some time dedicated to reading those books, to reading the cuadernos. And, you know, my botán at least made a conscious effort and said, okay, you know, you should probably spend some time reading, and I'll be here next to you if you have any questions, you know, just feel free to ask.
Wow.
And, you know, of course I had questions, and he said, you know, keep reading a little bit, you'll get your answer. And I was like, oh man, how does this guy know? You know, they definitely knew the books pretty well, to the point where he said, oh yeah, you know, because there's a section in a lot of the books that has, it's all questions, you know, questions for whoever was giving a narrative of different things. And he said, yeah, wait for it. It's the second question. That's your question. And I was like, wow, it is, you know, he was on point with that. So that was the day to day, you know, aside from definitely just spending some time, you know, getting to know each other a little bit more. There were times where we just listened to the radio and just listened to different programs and, you know, folks got excited like, oh yeah, that's, you know, Comandante this, or that's this person, and that's that person talking. That was this gathering that they're replaying a speech from, or that's this song, and mm-hmm. you know, I like this song, kind of stuff. Yeah. But you know, it was just a really deep, just relationship with getting to know one another. And you know, folks kept saying over and over again, I wish you could stay here longer. In a month, you would learn, you know, Tzotzil. Because I was picking up on the words a lot. Yeah. And, you know, folks were like, that's what this is called. You know,
yeah.
I definitely take an interest in the food. You know, I like eating. So I wanted to learn the foods at least really well. And, you know, I would share different foods that we ate and mm-hmm. different foods that I interact with. And, you know, there was definitely a lot of exchange as far as that level goes. So the point of that is, like, yes, we were there to learn, but I think it was also, you know, learning back and forth from mm-hmm. one another. And it was very intentional, you know. My guardian had a lot of questions for me too, just mm-hmm. as much as I had for him. And he definitely seemed very interested in what folks' struggles are and what are some things that we deal with and just how things are, you know, where we come from, this part of the world. And I did notice he was writing some things down. I don't know what exactly, but
yeah.
That was the experience from other folks, as far as I understand too. So I think it was a very intentional, you know, learning back and forth from one another. While we're in there.
And it's really powerful to hear you describe the what could be seen as sort of mundane details of your experience there, like you had a cold, so you had to go to the clinic, right? Like things like that, I think, are really powerful to think about, because what it did was expose you not just to the sort of formal, prepared experience of the escuelita, but it really immersed you in the autonomous system, you know, to be participating in the collective projects, to be participating in the day-to-day life of a family, and to be, you know, by chance having to access the autonomous healthcare system, right? You know, so mm-hmm. that kind of experience that went far beyond sort of anything that could have been planned, right? Yeah. That I'm sure it sounds like you took, there are things that you learned from going to the clinic that you never would have learned had you not gotten sick, you know? So, I mean, just sort of details like that, but that, or had you been camping in a tent with your friends for 5 days instead of staying in the home of a family, it would have looked really different also.
Yeah.
So again, I'm just like really blown away by the like depth of the experience and the way that it was facilitated. Again, because it's been so many years of attempts at different kinds of encuentro. And it sounds like the encuentro has finally really happened, you know, or is happening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you wanted to share a little bit more about your kind of day-to-day.
Sure. I mean, similar in the sense that just generally, we were learning how autonomy is created every single fucking day.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Like every day through, you know, we were being woken up at 4 or 5 in the morning to make tortillas and, you know, share that experience with the family. The thing is, we were going to work every day with them. So we would go to collectives or cooperatives, right, that they had the milpa. In my case, I went to a panaderia. We went to a collective pharmacy where they had a clinic as well attached to that pharmacy, and they received anyone. You didn't have to be zapatista. You could be people from the community that is part of a political party. And sometimes they would joke around that, oh, even the people from like the clinics from the bad government send send them over to our clinics because they're better than the ones that the bad government has, you know. But generally, you know, that was the experience. It was seeing folks work together to create autonomy. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Yet at the same time, they have so much time to spend together. Like, in other words, like, for example, we would spend time, hours, just hanging out with the family. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, oh, do we not have to, like, go work somewhere? Because, but we would be, like, hanging out with the family, hanging out with the chickens and the kids. And, you know, like, the father would be playing. And that was part of being, you know, in community and collective work, doing work in a different way, right? Like, it wasn't, to me, it was like, there was a, work was taken, collective work was taken seriously, but at the same time, spending time with loved ones in the community was also taken serious, just as seriously. And so we would play basketball amongst ourselves, like the whole community would come out and we would play basketball. And then after playing basketball together, we would have a like informal assembly where we also got two DVDs that the Zapatistas gave in the material about that they made themselves about autonomy, how autonomy is practiced in each community, in each caracol. So you saw different clips of communities talking about their experience building a collective of chickens, you know, or a collective panaderia. And so we saw them as the whole community, the DVDs. And it, that was an amazing experience in itself because we were learning with the other compañeros about other caracoles. And they were like, oh, look, they have a ganado. We should try to do something like that here. And so that also expressed how different each community is from the other, right? And how different each municipality is and how different each caracol is in that they experiment with projects in their own community. If it doesn't work, they try something else. They're not imposing anything. Every community has to have a chicken collective. That's not how it works. And so they just, you know, throw out ideas about what would work and what flies and what makes sense in their community. So,
And then Elisa reminded me of one other thing I forgot to mention, just kind of out of all of it, how, you know, every community or every caracol, every region is different, and how the work is... It's taken seriously, but it's really just so, you know, it's just so efficient that there's all this time left to really just be in community or be in family and share, you know, the rest of your life with people. But, you know, the other thing, the work and the day-to-day sort of just highlighted and really made visible is the political subjectivity that folks kind of always refer back to, you know, that... We're not doing this because, you know, it's cool to grow your own food or, you know, it's cool to, like, take care of your family. No, we're doing this because these are things that we need to take care of in order to make sure that our communities, you know, continue on. You know, we're not going to rely on bad government or rely on capital to take care of our nutrition or our health or all these things. We're just going to take care of those things because in the past that, you know, those things have... basically fucked up our communities, you know? So just always reminded, you know, any question I you know, noticed any question I asked always went back to, and this is why we struggle, and this is why we're doing this.
As a community, as a collective. Community,
right. Because, you know, we need to take care of these things. So always just being brought back to, you know, this political subject and this political relation that everybody has, even though they may be different in different places, you know, there's this understanding of we're doing this for autonomy, for regenerating our communities.
You're listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM in the East Bay and on the web at berkeleyliberationradio.net. This is Radio Autonomía, Autonomy Radio, Zapatismo in the Bay. We'll be back with the rest of our interview after a short musical break. Zapatillas de la calle, desde aquí para allá, desde abajo y arriba.
izquierda. Sembrando palabra. Vamos a empezar a caminar, aprender a conocer nuevas formas de luchar. Dignidad, libertad y ahora la sexta. Camina de la mano con hermanos. Somos todos soldados, con palabra luchamos. Somos todos soldados, con palabra luchamos. Sin fuego y con palabra, de abajo y a la izquierda. Sembrando fuerzas en silencio porque somos gente honesta. Porque somos gente honesta. Y estamos poniendo todo lo que tenemos en la lucha, resistiendo. Esperamos poder seguir creciendo, compartiendo y construyendo. Compartiendo y construyendo. No te distraigas con sus mentiras, que no te confundan, el sistema los domina. Ellos vendieron nuestra madre tierra, hermana agua, padre cielo. Nunca matarán el fuego que llevamos dentro. Tuvieron su oportunidad y no cumplieron. Madre tierra, te pido, ruega por ellos. O Pachamama, ruega por ellos. Ay morenita, ruega por ellos. Ay, Tonantzin, ruega por ellos. Ruega por ellos. Así somos y este es nuestro modo. Nos organizamos para luchar codo con codo. Si tocan a uno, nos tocan a todos. Así somos, este es nuestro modo. Nos organizamos para luchar codo con codo. Si tocan a uno, nos tocan a todos. Hermanos, les contamos que hace años que nosotros despertamos, que nos hartamos. Esta es la pequeña historia de cómo nos organizamos. El mal gobierno no nos escuchó y ahora vamos a contar lo que pasó. Nadie vino de afuera a gobernar, decidimos luchar, crear un mundo nuevo en donde quepan muchos más. En donde quepan muchos más. Y lucharemos por justicia, democracia y libertad. No como ahorita que no más para los que tienen capital. Libertad para negociar, no más para explotar. Justicia para los ricos que no quieren fregar. Democracia para pintar las bardas con propaganda electoral. Es lo que había y nada más. Y nada más. Es lo que había y nada más. Luchamos por un mundo donde quepan todos. Así somos, este es nuestro modo. Nos organizamos para luchar codo con codo. Si tocan a uno, nos tocan a todos. Así somos, este es nuestro modo. Nos organizamos para luchar codo con codo. Si tocan a uno, nos tocan a todos. Nos tocan a todos. Y en la selva se escucha el ritmo de los tambores. Miles de corazones unidos, buscando nuevas soluciones. Miles de rabia, un corazón. Música y revolución. Música y revolución. Música y revolución. Revolución. Así somos, este es nuestro modo. Nos organizamos para luchar codo con codo. Si tocan a uno, nos tocan a todos.
That's all really tremendous. Again, I'm just kind of like overwhelmed by everything you're sharing. And thinking back, you know, it makes me think back to the experiences I've had in the encuentros and a lot of the critiques that came up of the encuentros, which was that the experience that was presented by the Zapatista compas that would read statements that they had prepared collectively, you know, which many were statements prepared by, you know, ordinary folks from communities, not comandantes or comandantas, but that those statements, folks often questioned the sort of veracity of those statements, saying, oh, well, you know, they're painting a very rosy, optimistic picture. You know, this can't be really how things are. There's certainly things that aren't being spoken about. You know, we're not getting the whole picture, right? Which there was, you know, something understandable in those critiques, but it's also a kind of arrogant position to think we should have access to all of your secrets, you know? But this, again, sounds like it has sort of transgressed that, the limitation of that, of those previous encuentros, in the sense that there's no way that all the information disseminated by all the botanas and their families could have been orchestrated, coordinated, homogenized, right? And so it was really an opening even more than we've seen before, you know?
It was totally intimate and transparent in every way.
And to kind of, that's funny that you mentioned, like, that we should know all your secrets, because that was one of the questions, at least for us in Oventique. Somebody said, you know, what's the secret to Zapatismo or autonomy? You know, and it, we're laughing because a lot of the questions that were asked, like, some were good, some were just silly or whatever, but no matter what, there was always some kind of humor to the question that, you know, folks responded with. And if it was a new question, definitely folks would gather and, like, you know, take a minute and talk amongst themselves and answer it collectively, too, right on the spot. But anyway, so one of the questions was, you know, what's the secret to Zapatismo and autonomy? And, you know, they kind of laughed too and were like, well, we're not sure if there's a secret to it. And this was the second time they had mentioned that. They said, but all we know is that if we take things in this process that we're doing, that we're organizing and, you know, thinking things through collectively, we know we're on the right track. And we know that, you know, at least we're going to make sure that all these things are taken care of, you know, it, through that process. Mm-hmm. So it's like, there's no secret. The secret is, you know, that autonomy is hard work, and it's a day-to-day work, and it's not an easy thing that, you know, an arrogance would dismiss. Like, Right. Oh, that takes a lot of work. Nobody could do that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a lot of work, yes, but we would have to do that collectively because, yeah, not one person or not one vanguard or one group could possibly take that on. But a day-to-day and, you know, that spread out could.
And in practice. It's all in practice. It's all constructed in practice.
It was just funny, like, one of the questions was like, well, what's the secret? And they're like, well, there is no secret. The secret is we have to work fucking hard and we have to work together to do it.
Every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's an important point that, and you all know this already, but there's a point where the encuentros shift from us being hosted and us talking, us being the Zapatista Solidarity Community traveling to Chiapas and being hosted and talking. And then there's a shift after the Caracol kind of merges where the Zapatistas are talking themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was notable then that the Zapatista Solidarity Community, meaning folks from the north, mm-hmm. couldn't listen. And one of the complaints you heard over and over again was, well, they keep repeating themselves, and they're saying the same thing over and over again, from one Caracol to another, from one community to another. And that was especially voiced when women were speaking and talking about their daily experience and so on.
And I'm going to interrupt you just to comment that I was horrified to hear that exact sentiment on the first day of the Women's Encuentro,
mm-hmm.
you know, a few mm-hmm. years back. That Absolutely. Was the reaction of folks who were sort of considered themselves to be the closest to the Zapatista communities, folks that lived in San Cristobal, folks
Absolutely.
That had been going for years. They were saying,
Some
you know, after
friends,
day one,
dear friends of
yeah,
ours.
we were, you know, we shared this conversation before, which was, you know, the sort of outrage at hearing people say after one day or half a day of the Women's Encuentro, saying, oh, you know, it's just the same thing that we've seen at the last three encuentros. Like,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to waste our time. Like, it's going to mm-hmm. be boring. We're just going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that arrogance, mm-hmm. again,
Absolutely.
You know, is just mm-hmm. really shocking and mm-hmm. not shocking at the same time. But to hear that this was coming up mm-hmm. again and...
Well, but people couldn't hear. And then, of course, in those days, in those, that period of encuentro when it was shifted and the Zapatistas started speaking, we also stopped speaking to each other. As kind of the solidarity community mm-hmm. from the north present in the now this space convened by the Zapatistas. So for me, the Escuelita was a dramatic shift. And what really struck me, because I was in Sedesi, and our daily kind of experience was much more formal
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
it was a campus.
Right.
And, you know, there was breaks and it was who's going to hang out with the cool kids, you know, where are the cool kids spots. And, that was true of the Botanes, and that was true of us, the solidarity, you know, kind of foreign community, the people who were being hosted. And, you know, that was our day. But what really struck me, and of course this was kind of resonated when we, the three of us talked, when we got back together, after they got back from Oventique, that, you know, despite the fact that the Sedesi experience was very, you know, kind of much resemble much more a formal campus and a formal kind of learning environment. We still, the focus, for, at least for me, from my point of view, was still work.
Mm-hmm.
We still got that idea. We still were able to kind of get that sense of the importance of work
mm-hmm.
And the role that work played in constructing the assembly and organizing the assembly in relation, you know, from the family level to the local level to the community level, to the Mares, to the municipality level, to finally to the Caracol level. Certainly, they presented that, you know, as a political theory. They presented that, but they presented it in the narrative, the ethnography, this autoethnography of the, you know, this is our everyday experience of dealing with these problems. And they presented that. And, you know, they were very kind of focused, very kind of specific presentation. But what I'm trying to argue is that we were able to listen, I think, as a group, as a community of outsiders, we were able to listen in a way that we weren't able to listen, you know, that previous 5 years, 6 years of encuentros that made that shift. And we learned work. Even theoretically, we were able to understand work because it was very clear in CEDESI we weren't in the communities. And, you know, the idea was really to be out in the community, actually living and doing every day. We were totally in this kind of rarefied, theoretical, you know, academic space. But we still got that. I think that part, it in part was due to two things. One is that the autoethnography was incredibly sophisticated, and the cuadernos are incredibly sophisticated documents, and they're documents written for themselves. They're not documents written for us. They're made available to us, and they've constructed a space, they've facilitated a space for us to have access to those documents, but they're documents for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of the escuelita, where that came from?
Well, the...
That they were sharing...
One thing that we heard from different sources is that the escuelita kind of emerged in 2 years previous when the caracoles kind of converged and started talking amongst themselves about how to organize themselves as a network of caracoles and to share what they're learning as caracoles and to then kind of document that process and document their learning and then kind of start focusing in on that as a kind of dispersed community. That's the initial kind of impetus of the escuelita. In other words, it was totally for themselves.
Right.
So that they could archive, again we would say, you know, they're archiving their own process of how to represent the success of the of autonomy and liberty and democracy and justice in their daily lives and how they're sharing that within the caracol and then between caracoles. And then, of course, it wasn't long after that success that they realized or decided that it should be shared with others outside of Chiapas. And, of course, that begins this process of 2 years of kind of gestation of how would we do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the escuelita is the result of that. So we did talk, you know, in between breaks, at least at CEDESI, there was a number of us talking about the sophistication and the power, you know, and I don't want to overstate this, but like the magic of these documents. In that they're, you know, we would say, because we're academics, we would say they're autoethnographic. But it's a very sophisticated autoethnography. It's not a simple autoethnography. And so we were kind of thinking through all these questions amongst ourselves. You know, well, these are not easily translated documents. Because in the presentation, for example, one thing we talked a lot about in the breaks, that some of the words that they're using in Spanish have multiple meanings and have to be kind of understood in very specific contexts. So, you know, they're not, we would make grave mistakes to just directly translate certain words in Spanish. You know, we'd have to kind of really kind of understand the nuances of how they're presenting certain words
mm-hmm.
in different contexts to convey different kind of meanings around different experiences of autonomy.
Can you give an example?
Well, they say, for example, controlar over and over again. But they're not talking about, you know, like dominating a subordinate or dominating a subordinate level of community organization, right? They're talking about how to engage creatively, you know, how to creatively engage that portion of the community so it can, for example, fulfill its cargo or that, you know, there's communication between the levels of mm-hmm. Of governance, right? From the family level to the local community, to pueblo, to the municipality, to the caracol. There's a flow of communication and different levels of representation in an assembly that will function.
So coordination rather than authority.
Yeah, so controlar.
I mean, a basic
right.
anarchist distinction.
Fundamentally, right? totally, yeah. fundamentally anarchist.
The word that's always absent from Zapatista
absolutely.
Conversations, but that we all come back to over and over again.
Absolutely,
shit
absolutely.
Is the anarchist as hell.
But, absolutely, but at the same time, every other word is controlar.
Yeah,
and
but,
everybody's freaking out.
But it doesn't mean the same thing controlar
exactly.
ever means. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a number of those words. And, mm-hmm. and so in our daily kind of experience, we were kind of gathering and people were like gathering saying, what do they really mean by this word?
Right.
You know?
Do you think that there's something happening linguistically there that's a question of the choice of word controlar being a translation of a word in another language or of a concept in another language, and controlar is the term, just using this example, in Spanish that is brought in to explain it? Or is controlar the word, or are we talking about this coming from Spanish-speaking communities? Right? Because some Zapatista communities are Spanish-speaking, many are not, right? So, I mean, there's like multiple layers of translation always at play.
That's
there.
Exactly the issue, is the question of the politics of translation on one level, and then also there's some of us talking about trying to find a way epistemologically to even move away from the very notion of translation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that we're still arguing is still a very Western notion. Anyway, there's the conversation taking place. But essentially, and we've talked about this for a long time, the Zapatistas convene different speaking groups, that different indigenous groups that speak very particular languages,
mm-hmm.
Tzotzil, Tzatzal, Chol, Toholobal, right? And so there has to be a language that they're able to use. But one of the things that I discovered in the conversation with my Votan is that that they're much more able to kind of work in between languages than we would imagine. So like when we were just talking about this, sometimes a Tzotzil woman will get together with a Tzotzil man and they don't speak. Although the languages are somewhat similar, they actually have big differences. So they might start out speaking Spanish, but eventually one of them will learn Tzotzil or Tzatzal,
mm-hmm.
depending on where they're actually located in the rest of the family,
right.
and what obligations they're going to have in assemblies and so on and so forth, and what work has to be done. They'll speak in whatever mm-hmm. is much more prominent in that community. Or they'll also be able to speak Spanish. And it's something we talked about as a group, like driving back and forth from Sedesi. It's like, it's really modernity that means... It's really modernity that imposes a monolingual culture in the world, because most people prior to modernity would speak dozens of languages in the world and travel and have no problem speaking multiple languages. So that's one kind of question around translation. But the other question is around encuentro. How do we encounter each other without trying to force a certain kind of rigid translation, in that we're still imposing our language, our cosmovision, and insisting that it eventually it has to conform to that, as opposed to, what is it that we're really trying to communicate? And that's why I was fascinated by, even sitting in a kind of rarefied academic space, it's still Zapatista and still kind of La Escuelita, and kind of it's alternative and disruptive, but it's still kind of, we're in an auditorium and but we're still learning this experience of work,
mm-hmm.
and that was fascinating. Like the how essential work is to become part of assembly, and then to start taking on cargos. And for us, on our way there to Chiapas to participate in Escuelita, for us the question was cargo, because when we first imagined the Universidad de la Tierra, we all of us here talked about that. How do we imagine the Universidad de la Tierra Califas as a cargo? What's the cargo that we have to Universidad de la Tierra Oaxaca and Chiapas and the work that's being done there and the struggle that UNITIERRA represents there as a strategy? And so what's our cargo to that part of our community? And of course, how do we imagine cargo here where we don't have assembly? We don't have a habit of assembly here, really, in any kind of strategic kind of political sense. We have kind of these loose assemblies. Mm-hmm. But what work do we have to do to start convening or to construct some kind of social infrastructure so we have a habit of assembly so that then the cargo can be named and various cargos that are necessary for the functioning of UNITIERRA can be named here on our own terms, locally rooted way, based on work that we share. And I think what we discovered is that, you know, it's in the work and the doing of work that people have an experience of cooperative practice, you know, being in cooperatives and being in collectives, only in the work. Mm-hmm. And of course, here for us, that's been ideological. It's like we can only work together if we share an ideology, or, you know, we share a context that might lead us to an ideology.
Or we only work together when we go to that place that is the cooperative that we are employed at, mm-hmm. as opposed to cooperative work being a part of mm-hmm. our more integral lives. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that was a point that Lisa made, you know, over and over again. We kind of, and I should let you say it, but we say we either have, it's either or. We either have a cooperative, and we're in that cooperative, we're living in a squat, and we're living and doing all these things, or we're outside of a cooperative experience. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you might say more, but I thought it was an important point.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I noticed was, for example, in the family that I stayed with while I was at the escuelita in the community, one of the family members, he had his own milpa outside of the collective milpa, but his wife worked in the collective milpa. But his milpa was part of his family's milpa that they've had for a long time. And one of the things is that, you know, they also support a lot of people. It's not about, like, you have to leave everything and you only have to be in collective work. It's they cherish the fact that people can do the things that they need to do and want to do to support not only themselves, but the community as a whole. Mm-hmm. Another person, another compa that I met there was a farm worker in the Central Valley, actually, outside of Fresno. And so we talked about that, and he was telling me that his family was in need and the community was in need at that time. And so he spoke with the community in the and they all decided to let him go off for a year and a half to come to the United States and to work out here to support the community, to support his family. So, like, that there was a kind of the individual desires and experiences weren't denied for the sake of the collective, but as Ricardo was saying, in the end, everyone was always thinking about the collective. Mm-hmm. And not only their, like, immediate community or immediate family, but the whole, like, five caracoles.
Yeah.
You know, it always came down to that as well. So that was really interesting how nothing was, like, it wasn't oppressive in any kind of sense. And so people shared that. We're very open in talking about that as well.
That's interesting. Again, going back to this question of the kind of unprecedented transparency of this experience, because you touched on one of, I think, for me, two sort of unspoken topics in Zapatismo, which is migration and what really happens with gender dynamics on the ground, right? And the question of migration is always, in my experience, has responded to with a Zapatistas don't migrate. And then you know, hear the 14-year-old kid at the corner store in the Caracol talking about how he just came back from Cancun or whatever. And so you know that there's something very different happening, but the policy is we don't migrate. I find much more compelling the kind of arguments about the right not to migrate, right? Like an affirmation of the right to not migrate. But it's interesting to hear that you had this experience of migration stories being told very openly and very honestly.
Totally. I mean,
and not carrying a shame about it.
Right. You know? That was really actually very shocking for me and really interesting experience for me because I work with migrant farm workers in California and Florida. And then they told me, oh, yeah, we had another compa who was in Florida. I was like, oh, my God, who do I know who might be a Zapatista, you know, in Florida right now? And it's just, you know, like that, the fact that these folks, and, you know, they it's the same experience. They told me about crossing the border and how awful that was and how awful it is to be a farm worker in the Central Valley. And so it's just like really amazing to hear them speak about this experience that, you know, I thought was so disconnected from Zapatismo in a certain way.
Yeah, it really brings up the fact of the Zapatista experience is not isolated from the realities and the experiences of other indigenous peoples in the region and other poor people in the world, you know.
But that raises this other question that we, in this other discussion that we had with different groups, and that is, you know, part of the escuelita, the kind of the cargo of the escuelita is to share the information, to share the knowledge with others, and to kind of circulate the struggle, you know, kind of make this connection. And in kind of different contexts, we were talking with other folks and thinking about, well, how would we do that and how do we fulfill that cargo? And, you know, some folks, you know, would say, well, it's impossible for us to bring Zapatistas up to the States, you know, up north. And, of course, the irony is, well, they're here.
They're here.
You know, what it really means is how do we organize ourselves to engage them while they're here already, or to engage them because they know how to move. And then, of course, another level is, well, what is it that we're really trying to do in engaging them and thinking through the escuelita so that the escuelita moves? What did we really learn? If we're not there just to consume, you know, this is the old solidarity argument. If we're not just there to, you know, drop off a bag of beans and then consume, you know, bring back our little Zapatista trinkets and say we were there, what does it mean to really kind of circulate Zapatismo? And the escuelita is a profound challenge in that very idea of, well, we're not just inviting you here just for the hell of it. It's about circulating the struggle.
Can I share one of the so at the very end, so it was the beginning and at the end that we were in the Caracol, the center of the Caracoles, right? So Ventik, Morelia, Roberto Barrios, La Garrucha, what was the other one that I'm missing? La Realidad. Sorry.
Of course. That one.
Yeah, right, that one. And so, anyways, at the beginning, right, the first day we were in the Caracol registering, the last day we were in the Caracol with, like, a very huge general assembly of question and answers, right? So they had the maestros in the front answering our questions from our whole experience during that week of being in the community. And one of the questions that came up was, so really, it was, I mean, on the political level, it was beautiful and very, you know, exciting, the whole, like, escuelita experience. But on a, like, personal level and emotionally, it was just, it was really interesting because we were with families. We were kind of treated as part of a family, right? And so we made friendships and we cared for each other. And, you know, some of us, like, when we were leaving, saw some of family members crying and, you know, and our botanes and guardianas crying as well, right? So it was very, you know, touching emotionally to be so close and intimate with people in that way, right? So naturally, one of the questions that came up during the Q&A in Oventik, and I'm sure this came up in other Caracoles too, was like, hey, how can I, like, you know, keep in contact with my guardiana, like, is there an address that I can send letters to? And the response from the maestros was like, we didn't do all of this work and struggle for so many years to make amistades, to be friends, okay?
You guys, this isn't a pen pal club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys need to go and do work in your communities. And that was it. And that was it. Like, everyone's just like, oh my God, you know? And like, a lot of responses were like very straightforward. Like, you guys need to get your shit together and do some work in your communities. Because if you really want to like be friends with us, you need to be kind of here at this level struggling yeah. with us. And that was really, I mean, a lot of people were like, yeah, I need to go now, like go back. I'm so excited to go back into my community and do work, right? Whereas there, and then there was some of us who were like, well, we are doing work in our yeah. community. We have been organizing, and this only confirms, you know, like we can share with others this learning process.
So this leads to perhaps a concluding question. There's a million more questions that we could ask, right? I feel like there needs to be like...
I got a little teary-eyed.
Right?
Yeah. When we left.
I believe it.
I said, I can't talk anymore. I got to go.
I don't know how you wouldn't.
Take care, buddy.
Yeah. See you soon. It's not
we'll
goodbye.
Keep it dead.
Yeah. But the question of sort of what comes next, right? So we know that there's Escuelita Part 2 and Part 3 happening in December and January. So first question would be, what is that going to look like? Is it like the same list of students? Is there a new generation? Are you allowed to go back? Or how does that all work? And if you could say a little bit more about the kind of like, what happens to these materials, right? These cuadernos, like do these cuadernos, where were you encouraged to copy and disseminate mm-hmm. them, mm-hmm. the DVDs, mm-hmm. was there any talk about using them in, say, the university, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. what's the sort of immediate follow-up with the materials and the more formal follow-up with the schools?
Well, I mean, one issue that was talked about was exactly that. What do we do with the cuadernos? Do we recirculate them? Are we able to pass them along? And so
are they unscribd-y yet?
Yeah. There are probably some PDF floating around somewhere, and no doubt people are already PDFing them. But there was nothing formal or deliberately said about a PDF, for example, but it was said to share
mm-hmm,
this.
Okay.
Over and over again, the idea was to share yeah. this, you know, the materials, or share the ideas, continue this conversation, to organize what we're, you know, in our mm-hmm. own community. That was said over and over again. And yeah, it is a little surprising that they didn't already have PDFs. And, it, you know, a lot of people were, well, what's in the CD? You know, is the CD full of PDFs and stuff? So anyway, that's one next step, is to find PDFs. If not, we'll make them ourselves and mm-hmm. we'll distribute them. Another conversation that was taking place was, well, how would we kind of convene spaces to share this information and convene a learning space around these kind of this wisdom? And I don't think we have the answer to that. We're still processing that.
Well, some people have already, for example, in Puebla, John Holloway and Tischler organized this like post-escolita seminar. But that was, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like, I think that's the question, is how do we share this experience, mm-hmm. this knowledge, mm-hmm. this material? Is it going to be in this formal seminar
mm-hmm.
setting kind of context, or is it going to be in different ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So these are ways that, and I think we're going to see different ways that people are mm-hmm. sharing that.
Yeah, a lot of academic, intellectual, scholar activists left that space thinking we have to have some lectures and seminars around this experience.
Yeah,
and others were thinking, well, how do we convene different learning spaces to share this? And to share information that is not easily translatable
mm-hmm.
Politically and you know, just in terms of like we were saying around Spanish, you know, it wouldn't be easy to translate these documents.
Well, and now every one of the 1,700 students of the first round of the Escuelita has these mm-hmm. cuadernos with infinite appendices, right? Which
mm-hmm.
are all
mm-hmm.
of the sort of unwritten cuadernos that you compiled, you know, sort of in your mind as you were there with the families, and how to communicate that, how to document that, you know. I imagine some people were probably keeping meticulous journals. Other people probably didn't have a pen, you know, like there's probably the whole range. And what happens to that, you know, what happens to those 1700 versions, not to mention the 1700 times 10 on the other end of things, you know?
Yeah, it was interesting, you know, when I was in Sudesi, so, you know, there were a lot of people who've written about the Zapatistas who were in that.
There are a lot of pens there.
Space, yeah. And I was thinking, you know, I was sitting there very curious, you know, like, what are these cats thinking about this space?
Yeah.
And then there were other cats who, you know, like Raul Sabeki, who deliberately went into a community and, you know, opted not to be in the Sudesi space with all the intellectuals. And, you know, how was his kind of experience different than, you know, Neil Harvey's, for example?
Well, he's a journalist, not a theorist.
Well, although he
makes good theory, but, you know, I mean, disciplinary training counts for something.
Sure.
Speed of writing,
yeah.
Approach to learning.
Yeah. That was, but, you know, there were a lot of intellectuals who had fallen out of favor with the Zapatistas who were present.
That's interesting.
Yep.
I wondered about that, about sort of what had happened, because there had been so much, I mean, without even exaggerating, so much kind of expulsion that has happened over the last 7 years or so.
Well, and that's something we should talk about, you know, because, you know, we also, after the Escuelita, you know, we were in San Cris hanging out and kind of getting the skinny of what folks were thinking. And, you know, there's really two schools. You know, there's one group of folks who've been organizing around, you know, against dams, against mines, and every mega project that's coming, you know, down the pike, and doing some really serious organizing over the last, you know, 20 years. And, you know, at one time we're very committed and very active in the Zapatista kind of community orbit, you know, and now have kind of are disenchanted with the Zapatistas. You know, there's a lot of folks in San Cris who are kind of in that camp and disappointed that the Zapatistas aren't more visibly lending their political weight and their political capital to these struggles against, you know, that particular dam or that particular mine or whatever. On the other hand, you know, there's a lot of us, I include myself in this camp, that just continue to be enamored and committed to the Zapatistas on one level, but also thinking through Zapatismo in our own, on our own locale. But, you know, what I think one of the things that we need to take seriously is that, you know, immediately following the Escuelita, we had the Catedra Tata Juan Chavez that was convened that next day for 2 days, which convenes the Indigenous National Congress, which is, you know, those indigenous communities across the country struggling against these mega projects, and to, you know, again, converging in a space of encounter and sharing strategies and networking and organizing around these issues. And the Zapatistas convened that in many ways, right? I mean, that was the Zapatistas, even though they're not directly involved or very publicly present. So I think we need to kind of weigh that critique, and that's also part of the next steps. In our own case, you know, the Universidad de la Tierra community throughout Greater Mexico includes Puebla, Oaxaca, Chiapas, Califas, both the north and the south. You know, folks are organizing against neoliberal projects, and some, you know, very focused in all and kind of opposing the daily violence of those projects. And then on the other hand, we're also trying to think through, well, what kind of learning spaces can we construct that can excite people about autonomy and liberty and democracy and justice in different ways? Like in our own case here in the Bay Area, we're thinking through community safety and thinking through community safety in terms of defense, justice, and assembly. And it very much resonated with the lessons that we were learning in Chiapas and with the Zapatistas-based communities. You know, how do we organize ourselves in a self-determined way? how does that organization function in terms of an ongoing assembly that's, again, organized around work? And then how do we manage justice in that assembly so that when, you know, a cat makes, you know, when cats, compas, make an error, you know, there's an error in their thinking that they're able to readjust.
Mm-hmm.
They don't leave the community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a profound political challenge.
Mm-hmm.
How do we manage the errors in our community
mm-hmm.
in a way that doesn't expel a person who's part of our community? You know, that's not a discussion around restorative justice. That's a different discussion.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah,
without a doubt. So what happens with the next escuelitas?
Well,
do you get to go back?
No.
No.
Not the ones in December and January.
Yeah, those are totally new people. And what I was going to say about that is just that, and also that we've also been talking to compañeras that we know out here, and they're excited and they're also looking to sign up and go. So I think as far as what's next is, you know, encouraging compas from out here to continue going. That way we can continue sharing and talking about mm-hmm. the experience. And as far as next steps also is, and being able to share that with folks who later on go, is I guess for me, and, you know, we all talked about this also, is, you know, how do we also make very explicit that political relation, that political subject that we're all sort of engaging or wanting to engage, as we also engage and continue constructing and thinking through community infrastructures as Universidad de la Tierra, Califas, and in Greater Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the work, you know, because it's one thing to share the cuadernos, to share the textbooks, but it's another to really, as we've been saying kind of tonight, engage in that work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no way of learning it unless we're engaging in it. You know, and there's already a lot of folks doing these projects. The one that kind of struck me and made me rethink about things happening out here is gardening, right? We're not gardening to be cute or because it's cool or these things. No, we should be thinking about it more intentionally as we're going to take charge of our own nutrition, our own health, and, you know, we're going to have to think through how we're going to make the decisions on what we grow. You know, like if there's a network of folks growing food, for example, it doesn't make sense for every person to be growing tomatoes when one person can grow that and it makes more sense for their space, right?
Yeah.
Or the people who grow different
right.
things. Because that would get us into the habit again of, you know, assembling, making decisions, but also figuring out that day-to-day, you know, struggle of what's necessary and how do we determine that's necessary. And then when we make errors, how do we learn from that,
mm-hmm.
right? When we find out, oh, we didn't have enough tomatoes, let's just say, so maybe we should, you know, think about growing more, whatever, right? Like, it sounds very mundane and day-to-day, but I think that's part of us getting into that habit and making that shift, really, in how we think of our own work and our own labor in contributing to regenerating community in a very, you know, profound and meaningful way, you know, autonomous way.
And that was something that was said over and over again, that the Zapatistas learned by doing first,
mm-hmm.
and then, it, you know, extrapolate a theory.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something beyond that, you know, after. But it's they first do, and then they learn from what they're doing, not kind of theorizing it, thinking it through, and then trying to set it up. And they said that over and over again. And it resonated. I mean, after being there a week and hearing it, people finally started to get it, you know. It's
not just a theory.
No, and it's and it's epistemological shift for us.
Yeah.
So one other compromiso or project or whatever we want to call it, maybe I don't know if I should mention it or not yet, but one thing we've been thinking about is, like, how do we really, you know, solidify or make concrete this relationship where, you know, we can go down, you know, work with young folks here in the Bay Area, South Bay, and then visit, like, Unitierra, Oaxaca, Chiapas, maybe some caracoles nearby. And really come back energized thinking about cooperatives and collective work a bit more, right? So that we don't get stuck in this, well, what's the alternative for, like, let's say young folks, right, beyond college and training programs and just getting a job? But what's really some alternatives as far as like collective and cooperative work that we can definitely be engaging in? And I think, you know, a lot of folks would be willing and interested to also undertake, right? Including ourselves as we're thinking through it. So that's another project too, is how do we think that through? And also, so folks from, you know, Chiapas, Oaxaca, also have an opportunity to come up and engage in the projects we're thinking through and working with out here too in the Bay. Because a lot of folks want to know what context we're coming from, mm-hmm. you know. They know it's extremely violent out here and that we're dealing with a lot of defense projects, but they want to understand that context a little bit more in terms of race and how capital's working out mm-hmm. here, right? Because they don't experience it exactly the same way, although it's just as violent, you know. And we, in conversation with one another, we agreed that it's the same sort of narco violence that we're dealing with from the state and capital.
The Escuelita Zapatista of August 2013 was just the first round. At least two more sessions are being organized in December and January, and folks are encouraged to sign up now to participate. For more information, you can visit the official EZLN website at enlacezapatista.ezln.org.mx. Radio Autonomía will be back next month on Sunday, October 6th from 4 to 6 p.m. In the meantime, you can hit us up at radioautonomia@gmail.com with any questions or comments you might have. And be sure to visit our website, radioautonomia.wordpress.com, for our complete archives. Hasta la próxima, compas. Olvidan que tenemos tradición de guerra. Ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Sí, invencibles. Sí, invencibles. Invencible. Voy. Dedicación especial para la gente del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional. Para los pueblos indígenas en resistencia del mundo entero. Para la gente que se levanta, la que construye, la que avanza. Librando una guerra contra el olvido. Los años siguen pasando y seguimos en el camino. Aquí y seguimos en el camino. Allá. Yo prendo una vela por la esperanza y en donde solo habían tinieblas, un mar de luces avanza, un mar de luces avanza. Oh, esta rebelión es del color de la tierra, los corazones florecen si la semilla se riega, si la semilla se riega. Esta rebelión es del color de la tierra, los corazones florecen si la semilla se riega. Semilla se riega. Somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos invencibles. Hay que arrancar la mala hierba desde la raíz. Un nuevo sol sigue esperando para salir. Mientras el viento sople fuerte y se lleve las penas caminando, se va construyendo la senda. La dignidad rebelde levanta la voz. Que no se excluya nadie más en esta nación. Desde Tijuana al mundo entero exigimos respeto. Respeto para la gente y para sus derechos. Un mundo donde quepan muchos mundos pedimos. Ya no queremos otros 5 siglos más de olvido. No es demasiado tarde para entender que en la unión está la clave para vencer. No es demasiado tarde para entender que la unión está la clave para vencer. Ya lo dice la sexta, en la unión está la clave. Tú sabes bien que somos un ejército de soñadores y por eso somos
adoré.